and repeat after me. We lost the key of sight, now blind. We fear in flight. We are far from love, but silence is golden. Please observe. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to another night. This is Trick Track with Set Track. Another milestone tonight. We have another dear, very, very special friend, Carla Garapetyan. No, she's not related to me. As most of you know her, she made the movie Screamers a few years back. She's become a pretty good April 24 activist. She's been raising genocide awareness all over the world, and we get to talk to her tonight. We're going to be speaking about the UN, what took place last week. She was there giving a speech, and you get to hear some undiplomatic diplomats acting at the UN. Also, we'll be talking about the US policy, as well as the movie Screamers, and what she's up to nowadays. Hopefully, you can stay with us. It's going to be a lot of information given tonight. Tell your friends. You still have time. She's going to be coming on in about 10 minutes via phone from Los Angeles. I was very lucky to be able to schedule this meeting tonight with her, because very, very busy schedule she has. Actually, right after my show, she'll be driving to a screening of the Screamers. Anyways, without further talk, I'm going to play a couple of songs. Meanwhile, I'm going to try to get in touch with her. The next song is from Vikendi Shekenyan and Karnik Sarkisyan, Menki Cheng Sagain. And then followed by Dileyaman and Armenian Hoho by Hartar.
Չենք սագայն մեզ հայեն ասում, մենք մեզ ոչ մեկից չենք կերած ասում, բարզապես մենք էլ բիդ
di en tuneng, vormeng mi ai meng, arara duneng. Je vorreiste gebarstrik se vanum, jer ginke irgisht, bacene hanum. Barza besta vit naiste regervel, barza best na reg naiste regervel. Barza best ki denk, shairit svankerdel, karitsov shinel, gavits marzarkel. Vesemin lavin hamarash hadel.
Kichengayo, bajts kochvu menghai. Videnk der chansats verkerits dengal. Yem nor khndutyam tsntsalu hrtsvel. Videnk tsnamu bogam hrtsvel. U paregamin darnal achagits durs gal mezarvats parutyan dagits. Megi pokharen dast adutselo. Ogut artari evare kagi, kvyar gel yankov, voch mi yandemkov, is yete sangan, mes perni barel, menki denk machal, yem gerak marel.
Ոչ մեկից չենք հերաց ասում, բայց մեզ էլ գիտենք մեզ այն ասում. Եվ ինչու պիտի չհբարդանանք, գանք պիտի լինենք ուտեր շատանանք. Եվ ինչու պիտի չհբարդանանք, գանք պիտի լինենք ուտեր շատանանք.
Որ զամբե չկնա մեր անին, հայերը մնացին օդարի լդին, հայերը մնացին օդարի լդին, Արմենիա հողը երգիրը ծովը, Սասում ուշտու բանը հայկականովը, Սասում ուշտու բանը հայկականովը. Հրվել է հովիդը, ծրվել է խոդը, դշնամում մնացել հայոցանոդը, դշնամում մնացել հայոցանոդը, Արմենիա հողը, երգիրը ծովը, Սասում ուշտու բանը հայկականովը, Սասում ուշտու բանը հայկականովը. Դլեյամո
Yaman dele-i amam. Yes, que Ashna Novin Yaman Yaman.
Amendel urde mi hayga kurkuri tunaran hayastan doka kurkuri tunaran hayastan doka Armenia hov yergira dov sasunmuş duvanı hayga garov sasunmuş duvanı hayga garov Armenia hov yergira dov sasunmuş duvanı hayga garov Sasunmuş duvanı hayga garo Armenia hova yeri gire dolu Sasunmuş duvanı hayga garo Sasunmuş duvanı hayga garo Armenia hova yeri gire dolu Sasunmuş duvanı.
Okay, welcome back, folks. You're listening to Trick Track with Setrack. I have on the line Carla Garabetyan. She's joining us from Los Angeles. Hi, Carla. How are you?
Hello. I'm very well, thank you. I'm picturing you in Montreal as I'm driving along the freeway here in Los Angeles. At a very slow pace, mind you. But I'm really, really happy to be on your show tonight.
Thank you. Really, I appreciate it. I know you're busy. Before I ask you a few questions, I want to congratulate you because I just found out today that tomorrow Los Angeles City Council is recognizing your work about activism for the recognition of the Armenian Genocide. Really, congratulations.
Thank you. Actually, it's on behalf of the Armenian Film Foundation, which I'm a member of, and we are part of a project to digitize 400 Armenian Genocide survivor and witness interviews for an archive, which is a really amazing archive, which is accessible all over the world digitally, okay, held by the Shoah Foundation. So it's going to be an interesting ceremony, and it's also commemorating April 24th.
All right. Well, speaking of April 24th, what does April 24th mean to you?
Well, you know, every year it's different, and this year, the I'm feeling is, although it will sound funny to some of your listeners, I actually feel hopeful, and by that I mean it's usually a day where we're thinking about the victims of the Armenian Genocide, which officially, as we look back, started on April 24th of 1915. This year I'm feeling more positive because I feel that with this project I'm involved in, we're letting the voices of the survivors speak for themselves. And we're giving access to people all over to listen to these people. And I think if we can do that and expand the reach of our survivors' testimonies, then that's a positive step forward to spreading the word about not only what happened, but how we can prevent genocides in the future. I was also at an event on the weekend, and the artist Arto Tumpoyajan, who many of you may know of, the singer and musician, he was telling me, he said, why is it that the Armenians around the world are so sad about April 24th? He said, I survived, my family survived, I'm here. I mean, when he said, I survived, meaning, you know, as a grandchild of a survivor, you think, I survived.
Yeah.
So we should be feeling celebratory. It shouldn't be about sadness. And obviously, that's one point of view. But this year, I'm tending to agree with him. I think that, obviously, there is no way one can mark such a horrendous, catastrophic event with anything other than sadness and contemplation and reflection and, to a certain extent, activism to try to get the word out. but on the other side of it, there are ways in which we're moving forward that I think are historic.
Okay. Last week you were at a UN function, and something took place. Can you elaborate, please? Because from the stuff that I was reading, it was pretty diplomatic the way the diplomats reacted.
Yes, and you know, I have to tell you, it's now been reported in Turkey, and I was using Google Translate to translate from Turkish to English.
Oh, boy.
Good old Google Translate. I was very pleased to be asked to speak at the United Nations last week as part of a symposium about genocide, the Armenian genocide, and I was asked by an organization called ATOP to speak about the economic consequences of acknowledging the Armenian genocide. When I first was asked to speak about that topic, I thought, I may have to really think about that, because I usually talk about recognition and the political consequences of recognition and the whole issue of why governments do not recognize the Armenian genocide. But here was a topic that was outside of my normal scope. And I started to look into some of the research that's been done in this area, some of the court cases about various Armenian assets, whether they be bank accounts, gold, land, all the cases that are now being fought in courts around the world, particularly in the United States. And then I started to think about, what would the actual number be? If you could put a number, if we could start the process of reparations with a number, what would that number be? And the long and short of it is, I was due to give this presentation, and just before the presentation in New York, I was beginning to get phone calls about how there was all sorts of talk about this event, and people were looking at my Facebook page, and there was a certain amount of what you want to call buzz going on around it. And when I actually got to the event itself, it wasn't just Armenians who were there. There were various diplomats from the United Nations. It was actually inside the building, and there were several Turkish diplomats. At the time, I didn't really know who they were, but it became very clear because we were starting the presentation with a film, and the film is The River Ran Red, which is a documentary by the late J. Michael Hagopian. And in that film are many survivors from the genocide speaking for themselves about what they saw with their own eyes. And it was while we were showing that film that these two Turkish diplomats stood up and you know, I want to say ran out of the room. That's overstepping the mark. They actually sort of rushed out of the room. And it was, if you want to know the moment in the film that they did this, it was when a survivor, his name was Khosrow Pascan. Khosrow Pascan was talking about his eyewitness account of seeing two Turkish policemen who were taking bets over an Armenian woman who was pregnant. And the bet was over the sex of the child. It was two coins if it was a girl, and five gold coins if it was a boy. And what these men proceeded to do was to split open this woman's stomach and, of course, you know, killing the woman and the child and you know, seeing the sex of the child. And as soon as this horrific testimony was screened, these two Turkish diplomats rushed out of the room. And then they came back when the film was over and looked at me and the two other speakers, Professor Dennis Papazian and Professor Erwin Stobe from Boston University, and shouted at us, "You are defaming the Turkish state." And at that, the whole thing became first-class disruption.
Yeah.
The organizer asked them to please put their questions and remarks on a card, because everybody was asked to put their questions on a card. I think she had had some experience of this happening several times before, and in order to try to impose some sort of order on it, she, at the beginning, asked everybody to put their comments on a card, which they wouldn't do. They proceeded to shout, and so security was called, and they were escorted out. And that's pretty much what happened. And after that, this Turkish article recounted the whole thing. And instead of really going into a lot of the detail of what was going on, they they honed in on one of the parts of my speech. So, and interestingly, the part of the speech that they honed in on was the number that I put on reparations. And interestingly, well, I think it's interesting, I've just been taking out my calculator, I had studied what the Germans were charged for Jewish reparations. They were charged something like $60 billion. This is in 1953. And this was, through the state of Israel, a sum that they paid for the 6 million Jews who were murdered in the Holocaust. They paid $60 billion to the Israeli government in 1953 in an agreement with the Israeli government, which caused a lot of controversy in Israel itself, a whole other issue, but it was $60 billion. And in one of the articles I was reading, somebody tried to compare that to the Armenian case and said 1.5 million Armenians could be converted into the figure $15 billion if you use the German example. The German reparations example.
Yeah.
And so this article actually honed in on the 15. Carla Garabedian cites $15 billion, you know, the Turkey must pay. When actually, that number is just what the number would have been in 1953. And this is me adding a footnote. If you were to convert that into 2012 money, you know, looking into, you know, inflation and all of that, consumer price index, it would be something like $127 billion, not $15 billion. But be that as it may, that was the story. And I'd like to think that by putting that number out there and shaking things up a bit, that it gets people thinking about, you know, if we start to put a number on what the reparations really is, put aside the issue of land and territory, which is a big issue, put that to one side and say, right, just looking at the people involved, how much would it cost? How much would Turkey have to pay?
Okay. Why doesn't Turkey just accept and move on?
Well, that's a good question. What do you think, Setrag? I mean, I have my own opinion, but what do you think?
Well, I think they're afraid. They're afraid that they're going to dish out all that money and they're going to have to give back all those lands that they took from us.
Well, I do think that this is the core of what the resistance is about. I mean, clearly there is a history that has been told for decades, which many people, especially in the military or what they call the deep state, believe there's an ideology there which somehow ties recognition of the Armenian Genocide to an act of blasphemy, if you want to call it that. There is in the mind of these ideologues the idea that recognition has to do with partitioning the Turkish state, the Ottoman state, after the First World War, which is what the Allies wanted to do, and which is what, as many of us know from our history books, the Treaty of Sevres was all about. It was about punishing Turkey in the way that Germany was punished. Germany was punished by taking its lands away. And in the same way, Turkey was going to be punished by its lands being half of, or close to half of its eastern territories were going to be partitioned off and given to the victims of the genocide, the Armenians. And in the minds of many Turkish people, they believe that partition and recognizing the Armenian genocide are one of, you know, all part of the same problem. It's the big taboo. You can't talk about it. I think, and Taner Akcan, when he wrote, the Turkish historian wrote recently about this, he was saying, we have to separate, as Turkish people, we have to separate the crime from this whole issue of the formation of the modern Turkish Republic. And as soon as we can do that, as Turks, we will be able to release ourselves from this false history and recognize the crimes that were done by the Ottoman state. So that's a real problem. But I do think, on the other side of it, there is this issue about what Turkey will be asked to pay. And the sooner that the numbers can be discussed, fleshed out, both on the side of the Armenian diaspora and the Turkish people themselves having the freedom to talk openly about this, they will come up with their own point of view about what they think. And of course, Armenians in the Republic of Armenia are going to come up with their opinion about what they think should be paid. This is part of one big dialogue that needs to happen in a free and open democratic process. And I think that we're just at the beginning of that happening.
Okay. Do you think we could forego, let go of the monetary issue and just stick to the land and say, okay, accept the genocide and give us our land back?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. I think that where we're seeing progress is when it comes to the hard and concrete assets, like the bank accounts, the monies that were in banks, the Armenian money, the lands that were, the deeds where, you know, houses and properties and commercial properties and farms were taken over, and those deeds could be proven in a court of law. That's how the land issue is being addressed on a case-by-case basis, so that, you know, there is absolutely no dispute about it. There's no wiggling out of it. This belongs, for example, to take a good example, the Incirlik Air Base, which is currently being in the subject of a court case here in the United States. Those lands that were the Incirlik Air Base before was an air base, they were Armenian lands. And so the American concessions on the base there are being sued here in the United States. And so the whole issue of land is coming up, but in the context of stolen assets. It's very clear in international law, Cetra, very clear. It doesn't matter how much time has passed. If there are stolen assets, or, you know, whether there's a painting, or whether it's property, or whether it's bank assets, and those assets have been stolen, then it doesn't matter how much time has passed. It's stolen goods. And the heirs to the wronged people can go to a court of law and with the precedent of international law can fight for the return of those stolen assets. And that's where I think we've got some of the strongest power behind us when it comes to redressing this historical wrong. It's a long answer to your question. But that's where the action is. It's in the international court.
Because
and in the courts of the United States.
I find like that will come up within our community, within our organizations of what about the monetary stuff? Do we let go of it? If they recognize the genocide, I mean, I know they're not really near recognizing it, but let's say a few years down the road they do so. Are we willing to let go of the monetary issue, or it's gonna be a package deal. You accept it all, or you don't accept it all.
I think that, and this is just me talking as a journalist and a commentator, not with any greater expertise than that. But looking at the course of history and what's happened in other countries, where you've had, for example, in the breakup of the Soviet Union, or in the case of, you know, the South Africans having some kind of truth and reconciliation commission after the end of apartheid, where you have a population which has waited for decades for justice. And then suddenly there's that political change, and suddenly everything is on the table. And in each of these cases, these issues come up. You know, are you going to punish people? How do you punish them? What as a, you know, population are people going to accept as enough? Is it going to be enough to just have an apology? I think in the case of the diaspora, the answer will be no. No, that's on one side of it. It's not going to be enough just to have an apology. There is going to have to be, I think, as a political calculation of what people want, I think the diaspora is certainly going to ask for more than an apology. They're going to want some kind of monetary retribution, and the form that takes, we don't know, because we haven't started that dialogue. And so I don't know the answer to your question. I think it is that the answer has to come by us starting the process of having that conversation within the diaspora itself. And, you know, how many times have we sat down and discussed this? I would say not many times, because
yeah.
We're very centered on the question of recognition.
I mean,
not on the shape of reparations and what that's going to be and what we really want.
I personally don't remember of discussing it that often or actually that many times with my colleagues at my meetings, and I'm involved within the organization, you know. Anyways, it's something that we have, like you said, we have to sit down and discuss and openly and talk about it and see maybe we could work something out. I don't know. You mentioned about digitalizing the interviews. Can you elaborate on that?
Now, that's an interesting case of people who, genocide survivors who many years ago, and in a lot of cases, recorded their testimonies, their eyewitness accounts, and now, you know, all these years later, they are beginning to see the light of day. And in this case, Michael Hagopian, who was a documentary filmmaker, who died last year, he, from the mid-60s onwards, he made it his personal mission to record as many genocide survivors and eyewitnesses as he could. And in the end, he recorded people from 11 different countries in as many different languages. And some of them were not Armenians. They were missionaries. They were other, you know, Germans. They were people who were medical officers, American diplomats, all sorts of people who were eyewitnesses. And those interviews have been stored in film vaults since the mid-60s. And he's put those interviews in various films of his. In the last couple of years, we discussed, well, you know, what's going to happen to this collection? It needs to be seen by more people. And he thought that the best solution was to have it available in an archive which could be digitally accessed all over the world. So you wouldn't have to go to one university or you wouldn't have to come to Southern California. You'd be able to access the collection and those interviews by pressing a button on your computer and downloading the interview so that you could, for example, hear every survivor from Carcass or every survivor from, you know, Marash or every survivor from, you know, Tbilisi or wherever. And you'd be able to not only hear and see those testimonies, you'd be able to use keywords to search, like a Google search. And the archive that had that potential was Steven Spielberg's archive, which is called the Shoah Foundation Visual History Archive. And for those of you who may remember the film Schindler's List, Steven Spielberg made that film, and I think it was 1994. And he had so many Holocaust survivors contact him to tell him about their stories that he decided, oh my goodness, I need to record these people. So he ended up out of his own pocket. Nobody else paid for it. He paid for it. He had a team of people who all over the world recorded these survivors, and he amassed 52,000 Holocaust survivor interviews. And they lived at Universal Studios here in Los Angeles for many years, until he decided that, hey, I've got to put this collection in an academic institute, an environment where they can be studied, they can be indexed, and I've got to make them available to more people. And that's how they ended up at USC, University of Southern California, and up on this digital archive. So now there are about 40 universities around the world that can, through various portals, can actually access the archive. And now, for the first time, they're expanding the archive, and Armenian genocide interviews are going in there, 400 of them, and Rwandan genocide survivor interviews are going in there, survivors from Bosnia, from the Ukraine. It's going to be, Setrok, one of the biggest digital genocide archives in the world, which is pretty amazing.
Wow. It's really impressive. Basically, like I could go in and listen to a survivor anytime I want from home.
Yes, once it's in there, and you'll be able to go across genocides if you want. So, for example, if you want to know about women's experience comparing Rwanda and Armenia, or comparing the Holocaust Rwanda and Armenia, or you want to look at the whole issue of children and their experience in genocide, whether it be only the Armenian one or only the Holocaust, or you want to look at Cambodia comparatively, you know, you'll have the potential to do that because, you know, it's not just enough to have it up on a in a digital platform. You have to have a very powerful supercomputer that can power those interviews so that you can pull down several interviews and with a supercomputer's power behind you, you can actually compare. And that's what this interview, this collection of interviews on the Shoah Foundation archive will do. And the Shoah Foundation is a very strong supporter of Armenian genocide recognition. In no uncertain terms, says genocide, genocide, genocide. And that is, I think, an ally, a powerful ally that we want to have on our side.
Yeah, exactly. And your job is what within this organization or this group?
Well, I'm the project leader of the Armenian Genocide Digitization Project. So I am actually, with a team of about three people, we are putting together all these materials and all the metadata on each survivor and giving all the information that people will need. Along with that, we're going to be creating a special index for the Armenian Genocide, because the Holocaust, obviously there are words specific to the Holocaust. The Armenian Genocide has words that are specific to it. If you want euphemisms, words that have a special meaning. The word deportation, what does that mean? What does the word special measures mean? The particular brutal methods that the Young Turks use. What do those words mean? We're going to have a linguistic thesaurus, which is specific to the Armenian Genocide, so that when a survivor says a particular word, you know what it means. There were special operatives. Cheta was a word that was used then. Cheta referred to these groups that were specially commissioned by the Ottoman government to prey on and attack the Armenians on the deportation trail. And so if a survivor says the word Cheta, you need to understand what that means when you listen to that testimonial. So it's a research enterprise to make sure that we not only digitize these survivors, but we create an index which has real meaning for anybody who wants to research the Armenian Genocide.
Okay. So with this, can we conclude with all the rumors circulating that Steven Spielberg is not making an Armenian movie, a movie about the genocide?
Well, here's my understanding of it, and as I'm pretty close to the source, I'll just tell you my understanding of things. My understanding is that the Armenian movie commission based in Yerevan, the film office, is trying to encourage directors from all over the world to come to Armenia and take advantage of the beautiful setting and the amazing scenery and film in Armenia. And it is my understanding that they have made this approach to Steven Spielberg, and and he hasn't, closed the door on that. But that does not translate into making a movie, per se. And as I understand it, he's not actively in the process of doing that. But that is the news that I have, and I wouldn't want to say more than that.
Okay, fair enough. Okay, we're going to have to take a short break. We're going to listen to a song by Serge, and it's Genocide, the title of the song, and we'll come back and continue. So stick around, people.
Sergio. Serva kin mernem, sergyan kin mernem.
Welcome back. We're going to continue our talk. For those of us who are just joining us, we're speaking with Carla Garabetyan from Los Angeles. She's the director of the movie Screamers. She's been also a reporter. Carla, I have a question about the U.S. government. Why haven't they accepted the Armenian genocide, and why is it so important for us? I mean, we keep talking about it, we mention it. And why is it important for the U.S. to say, yes, the Armenian genocide happened, took place? Why is it important every April 24 we wait anxiously for the president when he promised that he would say Armenian genocide, he would recognize it, yet he says, I forgot what he had mentioned, what he had said last year, Ared or something, Medzegaren.
I think what Haru Sasunian, the columnist, is very good at reminding us of is that the United States has actually recognized the genocide many times. Why we keep asking for each president and Congress to vote in these various resolutions, I think it has to do with the fact that they've all been non-binding. They've not had any translation into actual policy. And the long-term policy of appeasing Turkey in its denial continues. That is the political push, the impetus for successive generations, if you want to put it that way, of Armenians in the diaspora to keep pushing for essentially for justice. Because we see the United States as having leadership in the international community and having leadership, I think, morally as well as politically, there is this, I think, very strong, passionate drive to have the United States president recognize it as genocide. And I also think that as long as our grandparents were alive, and of course, you know, the survivors of the genocide are mostly deceased, we felt beholden, we felt the obligation to do it because it just seemed wrong to be building a new life and somehow doing it without this injustice being addressed. So I think that there are a number of reasons why, and I think in a weird way, the campaign to get recognition has had an effect of galvanizing the diaspora in a way that we hadn't expected. So rather than it having the political effect that we wanted, it actually has had an effect on us. And I don't know how you feel about that, but certainly since my movie came out, Screamers, there's been a kind of pushback on the Armenian side. The pushback meaning being more vocal about wanting it, being more vocal about asking for it, not that that be demanding it, not being afraid younger generation, you know, maybe our parents were a little more circumspect, a little more polite about it. This generation is not so polite about it because we feel more confident as citizens of our own country. So we're saying, hey, as representatives of me, as whether you be an American or Canadian, you're representing me. I'm voting for you, and I don't want you to keep abusing Turkey. We're being more forthright about it. So And because of that, Turkey's pushed back. Turkey's pushed back because the Armenian diaspora has grown stronger and more vociferous recently in its demands. So we're living in interesting times where I think the diaspora, even though we are divided, and we see, and I think the whole issue of the protocols divided us, which is, I think, what Turkey actually intended. But that said, even though there are divisions, we are still very strong when it comes to this issue, and we're not backing down.
Okay. You mentioned Screamers. What prompted you to make that documentary? Obviously, the Armenian genocide, and you're Armenian, but how, what were you thinking? You said, okay, I want to make a documentary, and this is what I'm going to do. How did the idea come about?
Well, I'll tell you, I was very resistant at first because although I'm Armenian and both grandparents were genocide survivors, both sets of grandparents were genocide survivors, I obviously grew up with a strong identity, but I didn't see how I could add anything to the films that had already been made, the very fine films about the Armenian genocide, and I also knew how difficult it was because the images are so few and far between. It's not a particularly easy subject. However, it sort of fell in my lap because being based in Britain, I had made documentaries about a number of human rights abuses, and whether it be in Afghanistan, North Korea, Chechnya, and so I had 20 years of experience behind me, and when it came time to possibly take on this issue, I had the credibility, if you want to put it that way, within the media community, within the BBC, to take the subject on. And the BBC was interested in doing a documentary about the Armenian genocide because at that time, Turkey was opening up its campaign to be a member of the European community. So 2004, 2005, you can go back that far. And at the same time, Samantha Power had just come out with her book, which had won a Pulitzer Prize, which looked at the whole problem of genocide in the 20th century, starting with the Armenian genocide, which she called a crime with no name. So you had this very powerful book, and you had a contemporary political issue, Turkey joined the European Union. At the same time, this rock band, this heavy metal rock band, which was going on tour, had a lot of popularity with the young generation, so it gave it a new twist. Instead of a kind of, if you want to put it, a boring old history documentary, it suddenly became possible to do a film about four angry young men who were, I'm saying that, inverted commas, four angry young men. I
mean, yeah.
They're not really angry, but their music is angry. And to look at this in the context of a historical issue, which had become very political and very contemporary. So thank goodness they gave me the green light to do it. And I have to say, though, in the beginning, the executive producer, the commissioning editor, he wanted to go to a System of a Down concert in London to see for himself who this group was. And I was a little afraid that he was going to be, you know, thrown up on the arms of the heavy metal fans and end up in the mosh pit.
That would have been funny.
And then Carla would never have gotten the job or the commission, and, you know, history would have been a little different. But thankfully, that didn't happen.
And so far, I mean, how many countries has it been screened at? Have you lost count?
It's been on commercial release. It was released in the United States in movie theaters, and then it was it had a short release in Canada, and then it was shown. It was now been translated into 12 different languages, so it's actually had unexpectedly quite a life, an international life.
Yeah, because until today, I hear schools and cities and city councils and government officials still the film is being screened for them.
Yes, it actually was shown in several, in actually the Canadian Parliament. It was hosted by a Rwandan group about preventing genocide. So a Rwandan organizer of this human rights group wanted Screamers to be shown in Ottawa, so that was exciting. It was shown in the U.S. Congress, the British Parliament. It was shown in the European Parliament. We had a screening in Tokyo for United Nations, UNHCR. So it's had an interesting life. I'm on my way right now to Cal State Long Beach, which is a university in Long Beach, California. They're going to screen it. This time of year, university students from all over the country asked to show Screamers as a way to raise the profile or raise awareness about not just the Armenian genocide, but all genocide, including Sudan.
Okay. What are you working on now? Anything new coming out?
Well, apart from the Shoah project, the digitization project, I have been working on a movie, a feature film. So that is very exciting, and I'm looking forward to that. I don't want to go into too much detail about it, but it's been in the planning for a while, and as I've traveled around the world, several people I've met in different places, including Canada, have heard me talk about it. So it's the big secret, but as you know, Seth Talk, I have my eye on you.
Yeah, I know. now that you're on the air with me, I have a lot of witnesses. She promised me a role in her next feature film, people. And
I did. I just have to have discussions with your agent about, you know, whether I can afford you or not.
Okay, I'll notify Setrack.
Well, you know, I mean, on a more serious side, I really think that that part of getting our message out in the world is having some sort of voice in popular culture. And I think what System of a Down did, talking about, you know, music, what System of a Down did was really important because it shifted the emphasis away from the political arena into music and the arts. And I think music and film, both of them, have a way of touching people because it can access the emotions of people in a way that, you know, I don't know, print media can't. And we have our views, but it's not quite the same. When you go into movie theater and you see a movie, you're a sort of captive audience of whatever that filmmaker's vision is. And you have the opportunity to reach people really in a unique way. And I really do believe in the power of the visual media.
All right. Well, now that I know I'm going to be in the next feature film of Carla Garapetian, I feel much better.
Good.
What would be your message to our youth today and the general public to raise awareness, to become active? What ways could they do? Because often a lot of people think just going to protest every April 24, they've done their share, they've done their part. How else could they become active? How else could they start raising awareness about the Armenian genocide within their Shurchanags, I forgot the English word. You know, within their friends.
Well, I think it's a good question, and I think that from my experiences, you know, and having traveled around and visited Armenian communities all over the world, you do see common traits or common the successes where there has been an impact and where there has not been an impact, and I think. For me, what I see is that the whole issue of linkage, and by that I mean understanding that the Armenian genocide, it obviously was very unique to us, but genocides repeated in the 20th century. So to have a say about other groups who have experienced genocide, it's really important. It's very powerful to link up to, you know, Rwandan survivors from the Sudan, Darfur, Holocaust, and that really, really scares the current Turkish government. That is why they spend lots of money trying to stop the Armenian genocide from being exhibited in Holocaust museums. They're trying to stop Armenian exhibits about the genocide in the Kigali Memorial in Rwanda. They are not just trying to stop it in the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, but in Holocaust museums scattered around the United States. They're trying to stop the teaching of it in schools. So in this way, having a say about not just our genocide, but understanding others and joining in recognition and commemoration of those genocides. You know, the month of April, it's interesting how many genocides are commemorated in the month of April. I don't know what it is about the month of April. But, you know, Bosnia, Rwanda, the Holocaust, the Armenian genocide all seem to have their start in the month of April. So that's one way, understanding the power of linkage. The other way is, I think, understanding the power of social media. We know this already. You don't need me to say it. But the power of social media with regard to our issue, that you can be very small in number and have a very big impact on whether it be Facebook or any other group where people get together. For example, on the issue of domestic violence in Armenia itself, there was a whole campaign to raise awareness about the problem of domestic violence when a young woman, Zahrawi Petrosyan, was beaten to death. And through social media, a petitioning and people protesting and talking to each other, we collectively put pressure on that situation in Armenia and had an impact on the law there and the formation of new law. Do you think that matters? I think that matters. How many people were actually involved? I don't know. But I do know that whatever numbers there were, it had an impact. So understanding that is important. And the other thing is, I think that there's a tendency, and maybe you can help me with this and how it translates into action, I'm not quite sure, but there's a tendency to feel a certain sense of defeatism. Look, recognition hasn't happened in quite the way we want. It looks like every year we're just doing the same sort of thing or addressing the same issues. Well, I don't think that's true. I think going back to what I said before, we have to congratulate ourselves as a community, as a diaspora, as how successful we have been over the years. We're small in number, but look what we've achieved. We've kept this issue alive. And the Turks are pushing back. They're pushing back. Why? Because of us. So anybody who thinks that getting together and organizing and protesting, whether it be on April 24th, they should think again. They also recognize that there are people who are fighting for justice in Turkey itself, like Rajiv Sarakolu, the Turkish publisher. I was in Toronto a month ago, and the Toronto AYF had an event. Part of that event was to draw attention to the imprisonment of Rajiv Sarakolu, who has published books on the Armenian genocide and has been persecuted under Article 301. So having a say about Article 301 and fighting for the civil rights and the freedoms of ordinary Turkish citizens, I think that we should be involved in that too. Because the more say we have about that, the more we make this about a humanitarian cause and a civil rights cause, the better. And that's a new message to the youth, the Armenian youth. It's widening the scope of what we're protesting about.
Well said. I know we don't have a lot of time left because you're trying to get to Long Beach, but I have a listener that just emailed me, wanted to know if I could ask you. It says, Setrak, please could you ask about Israel Organization of Genocide and the outcome of Israel's on the USA? I'm not 100% sure.
Did you say Israel? Because
you cut out slightly. Yes, it says, could you please ask about Israel Organization of Genocide and the outcome of Israel's on the USA?
Right, good question. You know, there's been some movement there by various cabinet members, and you know they've had several attempts at voting on recognition of the Armenian genocide in the Knesset. So I'm afraid I'm not as up as I should be on the latest situation. So I don't know. But here in the United States, there have traditionally been several lobbying groups who have been against recognition, who traditionally are, part of what's called the American-Israeli lobby. One of those groups is AIPAC. And AIPAC has been very consistent in not recognizing the Armenian genocide. However, there have been other groups who have been supporting recognition of the Armenian genocide. So I think the underlying interest in the question that came in that email was, well, where are we with Jewish voters or the Jewish lobby? Is it, you know, what do we make of it? And I think the answer is it is not a monolithic lobby. It's one that has organizations like the Shoah Foundation, which say genocide, 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 and lobby groups like AIPAC in the United States, which are not recognizing. So, and represent the problem within the context of a national security issue, meaning that the United States can't be involved in this because Israel is allied with Turkey and can't afford to upset the apple cart on this issue. So So that's not really an answer to your viewer's question, but it's a roundabout way of answering it.
Well, I appreciate it, and I'm sure he does. I want to thank you. Really, really appreciate you coming on and talking to us and giving us all this great news, and especially about me featuring in your next movie, feature film. So Hollywood, watch out. And
Hollywood, watch out. Yeah. Tetzlock is coming. And we should also set the record straight, Tetzlock, that we aren't related. So there's no nepotism involved here.
Yes.
If I cast you in my movie, right?
Exactly. Yeah, because you spell your last name with a T, I spell it with a B. So there we go. We set that one clear as well. Okay, Carla. It's always a pleasure talking to you. Really, really, I can't thank you enough. And we'll keep in touch.
Thank you, and take care, and I hope to talk to you soon.
All right, we shall. Have a good night.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed our chat with Carla. She spoke about a lot of issues. She gave us a lot of information. And yes, I'm going to feature her in her next film. I'm going to act in her next feature film. Now, it's time for me to say goodnight to all of you. But before I do that, I just want to mention a few functions that are taking place May 5th. Next week, obviously, there's a lot of April 24 protests going around. I've been sharing them. You could share them too. Whenever you see one, let your friends know, and friends of friends will find out about it. May 5th. It's the 20th anniversary of the Shushi Liberation in Montreal. There's a celebration at the Montreal Community Center. It starts at 7:30. It's free admission. And whatever money is going to be gathered that night, I would say, or raised that night, it's going to go all to the fund of the Asada Mardiks families. Also, May 20, don't forget the ANCA telethon that will take place that day, May 20. I believe it starts at 2 in the afternoon here and 5 in LA, or vice versa. Next week, we will have a trick track with Set Track, and it's going to be again April 24. I cannot tell you the guest because it has not been confirmed. I've been working very hard on getting us a Turkish scholar or a representative to come on air and talk to us about the Armenian Genocide. I will not give up. I will hopefully succeed again to get somebody to talk to us. All right. And with that said, I want to wish you all a happy weekend. Thank you for tuning in. Keep on tuning in. Don't forget to hit the like button on for Facebook for the Trick Track Show. And now I bid you farewell with a gentleman where we say we're survivors. His name is Aren Emirsyan. He's from Germany. He's Armenian, and he's made a CD in Armenian, and you'll love it. You will love his voice. Enjoy it. Have a good night, people. Thank you.
done.